Award-winning writer Nick Mamatas is an East Coast transplant to Oakland, California, where he plies his trade as an author of many stripes. As you will soon learn, Nick has interests that cover a wide and unusual range of material. He is the author of several novels, including a Lovecraftian beat road novel, Move Underground. Yes, I did just say what you thought I did. And Under My Roof, a novel of neighborhood nuclear supremacy. Sounds like it could be set in Santa Fe or Los Alamos, doesn't it? And as someone who clearly has empathy for those of his kind, Nick wrote a how-to pamphlet on writing called Starve Better, which was released in March of 2010. Mamatas has also published over 150 short stories and hundreds of articles. His short fiction has appeared in Asimov's Science Fiction, Mississippi Review Online, Subterrane, Hint Fiction, Supernatural Noir, and many other publications. His reporting and essays have appeared in The Village Voice, The Smart Set, Clamor, In These Times, The Books You Are Being Lied To, and Everything You Know Is Wrong, H+, Poets and Writers, The Writer, and many, many other places. But now let's hear what Nick has to say for himself and his work. Nick, tell us about you.
Hello, thanks for having me. Oh, about me. Gosh. let's see. I am a writer, as you said. I've written several novels, 150 or so short stories, mostly in genre fiction, science fiction, fantasy, horror, crime fiction, the occasional bit of experimental fiction. I also have edited anthologies of short fiction and nonfiction, mostly co-edited them with other anthologists. I've worked in a bookstore. I have worked in the field of manga, which is Japanese comics, bringing them over here to America. And that's pretty much been the business I've been in for 20 years or so.
I understand that you also are, you're an award-winning writer, having won the Bram Stoker Award. Tell us a little bit about how that happened.
Well, I actually won for an anthology called Haunted Legends, which is basically a concept I thought of. Many people like what they call true ghost stories. You know, if you go to any gift shop or any locally themed store, every town has their book of true ghost stories. I'm sure Santa Fe does, the Bay Area does. But the obstacle there to an enjoyable reading experience is that they're written by one of two types of people. Either a true believer, who is, you know, very woo-woo gonzo about these ghosts, or the local folklorist from the university, who is a very dry writer. And so my innovation was to get real writers of fantasy and dark fiction who write these true ghost stories, but to give them plots and structure and themes. And I actually pitched this idea back when I was a member of the Horror Writers Association, which is like a trade guild for horror writers, for their anthology series. And I said, well, that's a great idea, but you're not famous. can you find someone who's famous to do this with you? And I asked Ellen Detlow, who is a famous editor, which is almost a contradiction in terms. Editors aren't famous. But I I've been reading the work she'd edited since I was 9 years old in Omni magazine. Mm. That, Guccione magazine, the same guy who did Penthouse, he did the science magazine called Omni. And she thought it was a great idea. And we thought it was such a great idea, we didn't do it with HWA. We just went to via Ellen's agent to Tor Books, and they loved the idea, and they bought the book. And then Robert Jordan, the famous author of Wheel of Time, died, that huge fantasy series. And so we didn't hear from Tor for 2 years, because whenever you'd call them up, this is the theme of it was, oh, my God, Robert Jordan said, what are we going to do? And so they wouldn't get back to you. But finally the book came out, and it won the Bram Stoker Award, which was the HWA's award, so it was no hard feelings. And it was also nominated for the World Fantasy Award and for the Shirley Jackson Award.
Wow. Okay, so clearly a good new twist on ghost stories.
Exactly, yeah. Contemporary ghost stories that change the story a little bit.
True Lies?
Exactly.
Very good. Well, that's horror. The Planet Breaker's Son, your current novella, that's science fiction.
Yeah.
Tell us about it.
Well, I guess the three themes of the Planet Breaker's Son are, one, I have a kid. And I used to work in a bookstore, and in the bookstore, of course, there are many, many books that are called the fill in the blank's daughter, or the girl. And I just thought it was weird and interesting that there was nothing like the fill in the blank's son. So I came up with the title, The Planet Breaker's Son, first. So one, the main theme is having a son and working through that. The second theme is that I like hard science fiction. I'm not really a good hard science fiction writer because I don't have the mathematical or engineering background, but I'm pretty good. I'm good enough to find a lot of science fiction annoying. And one thing I believe in is that I don't believe that we're going to get on spaceships and colonize Mars as human beings, no matter what Elon Musk says. He might go, but where the rest of us aren't following him. I think we'll explore deep space via simulations, personality emulators. Because it's much cheaper to do that than it is to put up a can of meat, you and me, and oxygen and food.
Yeah.
And have it be a one-way trip. So the Planet Breaker Sun is about when the Earth becomes uninhabitable. It's not human beings in our meat sacks going into space, but our recordings are our personalities, some of which are better than others going into space. And the third thing, the life-changing thing for me was going to college in 1989 and someone sitting me down saying, hey, do you ever hear the internet? And I hadn't. I said, well, here it is. This is before the World Wide Web and before cell phones, smartphones, and anything like that. And there are places called TinyMuds, which were kind of a chat program, kind of an object-oriented experience so that you can go from room to room. They had descriptions. There were things you could handle, all via typing. But even though I was just looking at words on a screen, on a green screen, on a black screen, the green letters or amber letters, not even a Windows-based type of operating system, it felt like a real experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I spent years on those, and then I grew up online, became a writer online. You know, the idea of me making a phone call through an editor or even sitting down and writing a physical letter with a carbon copy and something like that was just impossible. So the internet made me a writer. And so the world inside the spaceship that are full of personality emulators are kind of like these virtual worlds which exist non-topologically. You could have a beach connected to a mailbox, connected to ancient Greece, connected to a black hole. And it was about how people would live when they can change their environment so radically and so individually. And the answer was, not well. So those are the three themes of the Planet Breaker's Sun.
It's published through PM Press. Is it out now?
It is out now, and it's part of a series that PM does called the Outspoken Author Series. So it's a numbered series of small novella-length books with a novella and another short story and an essay and a Q&A with a series editor, Terry Bisson. And they've had very famous authors like Ursula K. Le Guin and Joe Lansdale, John Crowley, throughout the series. I'm the 26th outspoken author book. And I'm not as famous as Ursula K. Le Guin. You may not have noticed this, but I'm not.
And you're so, working on it.
I'm climbing the ladder. Well, she wrote a small story, and most of the people write short stories. I said, how am I going to get people to buy this book? So I will use all the space to write a new novella, something that feels like a real book-length thing that you can spend an evening or two evenings reading.
You've also been nominated for 2 Hugo Awards, so you've certainly got your science fiction chops.
Yeah.
What were those for?
The first one was for a magazine I co-edited back when I first began, called Clark's World Magazine, not for Arthur C. Clarke, but for Neil Clarke, the editor and the publisher of the book, not the magazine. And Clark's World kind of made a splash by publishing new authors and paying them what we call a lot of money, which is not a lot of money. It was a dime a word at the time. In those days, the magazine section of the Hugo Awards was really dominated by the print magazines from the 20th century, Asimov, Science Fiction Magazine, Analog. The same ones would be nominated every year, so it was kind of interesting that we got nominated one year. Then I left, and it won. So once I was out of the magazine, it started winning Hugo Awards. The second one was for my erstwhile day job at Hakosuru at Viz Media. This was the Japanese stuff I was talking about. I was in charge of an imprint of bringing Japanese science fiction into the Anglophone world. And so Japanese science fiction is very hard SF. It's basically strongly based on physics and equations and heavily influenced by Heinlein and other writers from the mid-20th century here in the U.S. And there's a segregation of fandom, and the Hugo's Award, they're voted on by the people who attend Worldcon, the big science fiction convention every year. So they liked hard SF, and they liked what I was doing, and so I got nominated for Best Long-Form Editor one year.
Nice. Tell us a little bit more
about... all editing. I never won anything for my writing. Just for the most part, editing.
Just for talented editing.
That's right, for talent scout and sniffing things out.
Tell us a little bit more about, as you said, the Japanese stuff. I mean, what originally drew you to that? Was it the fact that you're interested in hard science fiction?
It was interested in science fiction at all. I saw the job posting, and I applied, and I remember receiving a phone call. I was living in Somerville, Massachusetts at the time. And they said, so do you like anime and manga? And I said, no. which I thought at the time, oh, that was a mistake. They're not going to call me back. But it was what they wanted to hear. They wanted a science fiction person, not a manga anime person.
Got it.
Manga being the comics, anime being the animation, the cartoons. Because whenever any of these manga firms put up an ad, they get hundreds of resumes from people who have no qualifications whatsoever, but they love anime and manga. So having shown myself not to being a yes man, they brought me in for the real interview, and I was there for 11 years, and we had some successes and some failures. The big success was, of course, a book called All You Need Is Kill, which became the film Edge of Tomorrow with Tom Cruise.
Right.
Yeah, so that was something I had a small part to do with. I wrote the log line. I wrote a first treatment. I pitched it internally to our movie producer. And amazingly enough, it became a film. And a pretty good one.
Absolutely. And I think that's actually it's one of those films that has aged really well over time. I think there was maybe some initial hesitation to it when it came out. And now it's really considered a fan favorite.
Absolutely. Yeah, it was, of course, this was like my life on the line on some level here. So I remember when the box office came in, I never really cared about box office numbers. I wasn't one of those film goers. But I remember saying, oh, my God, it's number three. And you can't be number three. You got to be number one. But then on week two, it was number two. And on week three, it was number three. People, word of mouth kept people going back. So instead of having been to number one and falling apart, which is what all films do when they're number one, unless they're like the Titanic or something.
Right.
It had positive word of mouth, and people stuck with it, and people stuck with it on DVD, and people are sticking with it now. Even today, even though I no longer work at Viz, I now work at another company called Seven Seas, doing more traditional manga, the comic book. I still get my name attached to it sometimes, and people talking about it sometimes, and I see it because the internet just sends me the result. And it's amazing that the other films that were number one and number two that week are not being talked about at all. I wouldn't even mention them here.
Well, and I know it's trending right now. For example, I think on Netflix. I mean, it's one of the most watched in the country for some reason right now. It's become really popular again.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was a good one to be. That's a good one to have your name tied to.
Absolutely. It certainly opened some doors and closed others, as all things do.
Indeed. So speaking of opening and closing doors, you are originally from the East Coast, from New York.
That's right.
Is that where you did all your growing up?
Yeah, I was there for 34 years, within a few miles of I grew up on Long Island and in Brooklyn. When I struck it on my own, I moved to Manhattan and couldn't make it there, because who could? Then I was in Jersey City. And only into my mid-30s, I said I'd move somewhere. I moved to California. I lived there for a year. Then back east, because I didn't like California that much. And I made the foolish decision to fall in love, which was even worse. So I lived in Vermont for a while, then Boston. Then I came back here for the Viz job.
As we mentioned, you're in Oakland. How do you like it?
It's great and terrible. That's what California is. California is great. The weather is fantastic. Then everything bursts into flames.
Yeah.
There are so many opportunities. But that just means that... Like when I was working at Viz, we were working in the mid-market section of San Francisco, which was a really run-down section. And they were trying to rehabilitate it by giving companies corporate subsidies to move to that area. So Twitter most famously moved to the mid-market section of San Francisco. So my job would be going to the BART, which is our local commuter rail, climbing up the steps, stepping over the syringes from the heroin addicts, stepping over the human feces left on the floor by homeless people, and then walking into a lobby where you had an oyster bar and the fanciest coffees you'd ever seen in your life. And all these Twitter employees who were making, $10,000 a week. So it was like living in a young adult novel where everything is squalid and awful, except that the elite had this tower that they lived in. And of course, there was no way that the city was assisting the poor people in the neighborhood. They were just happy to displace them, to push them along, to help them suffer. And it wasn't even like gentrification, right? If a neighborhood gets gentrified, at least our first artists. And at first, some community coming together to try to save the neighborhood and something like that. But it wasn't like that at all. It was just a hyper-gentrification, just from one day to the next. Awful, a tower up, and it's $4,000 a month studios. So California's awful and great at all times.
Yeah, and you've kind of laid it out very clearly for everybody.
And one day we'll fall into the sea when the earthquake hits.
They keep saying. We'll see. Maybe it'll float.
One hopes.
You are listening to KSFR's interview with science fiction author Nick Mamatas.
I mean, that was the greatest thing to get used to, but being from the East Coast, I'd always be walking down the street or sitting in my home thinking, oh, that's a subway going under my feet. Wait, there's no subway here. There's no big trucks outside. This town is trying to kill me.
Are you all due for the big one anytime soon?
I think so. I think there wasn't the last week like something like 16,000 earthquakes in Iceland?
Yeah.
Right before the volcano goes up?
Yeah.
Of course, we're observing the 11th anniversary of the horrifying earthquake and tsunami in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems, you know, it's always on my mind, is there going to be an earthquake? This is one reason why my parents never visited me here, except for one three-day event after I had my kid, because my father from Greece is terrified of earthquakes. Because that's another prime area for the earthquake.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's also a very active place.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
For that sort
of
thing.
And he grew up in an island called Ikaria, which is right by Turkey, which is also highly active and seismically active. So I've made the same foolish decision that my thousands of years of ancestors have, to live on top of a fault line.
Well, hey, if it's keeping you happy.
Of course it is not.
So you have, you mentioned you have a son.
Yes.
How new of an addition to your family is your son?
He is 7 years old at this as of this recording.
So not fresh, but pretty dang new.
Pretty dang new, and with new experiences. Like, of course, I had gone to school myself, but I had never not gone to school for a year, as he had to because of the COVID virus. So it's the newest kind of new territory, even if he's been around for a few years.
What do you think of all
I've learned
that?
How to Zoom, like many parents. Oh, it's the alternative. Right, I'm definitely not in favor of opening schools. And, of course, I have some privilege there because I work from home, was able to help him out. His mother works for the school district, so she's home, too, when they need to be home. But it's, you know, obviously terrifying, and I'm just very lucky that none of my close relatives have had COVID. The relatives I have who had COVID, of course, or I have, like all Greek people, I have a million cousins. So I got, of course, had a few hits, but nothing that got so terrible. Nobody was on the ventilator. Nobody died. So I've been luckier than I had any right to be as far as this plague goes. And as far as challenges go, yeah, working with Zoom and finding out that they teach things in first grade totally differently now. Like, I had no idea. I'm a writer. I've done 28 books. I read it in 200 books. I had no idea what a closed syllable was until yesterday when he had to take a list of words and say which ones were closed syllables, which ones were open syllables. I just never heard the term. And I did all right, English-wise, I think. I'm on the radio about it. But I still have to retrain myself.
Well, we all see the world anew through our children.
Absolutely. And just the other day, he has what they call a writing workshop in first grade, where they teach them how to, you know, write English artfully if they attempt to. And the teacher said, and you use an ellipsis to build suspense. And I had to turn off the Zoom and say, don't do that. That's not what ellipses do. And turn it back on.
It's good to have writer dad right over your shoulder.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
What would you say are your greatest influences to your writing, or what are, and if not your greatest influences, what's currently influencing you in your writing?
I guess traditionally I liked a combination of science fiction and fantasy, often from the 70s and 60s, and horror from the 80s, and experimental fiction and new narrative from the 90s. So this is why I'm not famous. Since in writing today, you have to pick your lane and you exploit it endlessly. And I'm always trying to think about the next thing. Like, oh, what else do I like? And so I like Harlan Ellison, who couldn't write a novel to save his life, but was a fantastic writer of short fiction and essays. And I write a lot of essays and short fiction. And horror writers like Katha Koja, who combined examinations of the art world with scary stuff. Elizabeth Hand, that's very similar.
Mm-hmm.
More recently, I started getting into noir and crime fiction, because science fiction and fantasy are difficult to write. But at the end, you can kind of fake it a little bit. You can say, oh, and then something crazy and impossible happens. The end. With crime fiction, you have to stick with what people would do and how police actually work and what does this airplane actually do. And I spent last night, I was up to midnight, trying to figure out how to fly an airplane without having to follow a flight plan. How big can the airplane be? Oh, it's got to be VFR. Oh, you got to land in this airport, not that airport. And that worked out for my scene, but it was definitely 3.5 hours of researching to write a 5-sentence scene. So that's crime fiction for you, and that's what I'm into now. I had a story in Ellery Queen Mystery Magazine last month, and I've got some other crime fiction stories coming out here and there. So I like to experiment with genre forms a lot.
Tell me about the essay in The Planet Breaker Sun.
Yeah, so every outspoken author book has short fiction, but also some bit of nonfiction, and mine is called The Term Paper Artist, which is about my years, my way too many years writing term papers for a living for college kids, and my misadventures there. And when it first came out, it was a big hit. It got viral. I was on the radio. I got a lot of angry letters from people saying, how dare you write these term papers? And a lot of curious letters saying, hey, I've got a PhD and no job. Can you tell me more about writing term papers for a living? And it's disappeared. It's been reprinted a couple times in textbooks about writing term papers. And the theme basically is that there are several different types of term paper students, some of whom are just, I don't want to go to school. I don't want to learn nothing. You write, do my work for me. Others who are just not good at a certain class. Like I got a lot of chemists who are, have to do a poetry class. Of course, if they're not going to use this, their themes of Edgar Allan Poe in their chemistry career. So they're happy to farm that out. A lot of them were highly educated people from former Russian republics, former Soviet republics, whose education, whose credentials were useless here in the United States. Or they were a physicist home and driving a cab here.
Mm-hmm.
So they had to go through the school system again to a certain extent. And there are people who were just desperate one day to get a term paper done, having done most of their own work all the time. And so I wrote enough term papers to buy a house in Jersey City, a dumpy house, but a house nonetheless. And I was able to stay home and work on my real writing. And I will say, for those who dislike the idea of term paper writing for a living, I've been punished severely for it because I can't write commercially anymore forever. Because science fiction fantasy are based on writing these giant books. And you write one giant book a year in the same series, the same characters. But writing term papers taught me to write short, fast, and to stop and do something else. And so I can't get together like these 100,000-word epics with these beautiful characters you fall in love with. I write these, you know, small, terrible books like people you dislike. Because I disliked writing term papers, but I was really good at it. And so I'm imprinted on my production speed is imprinted on still writing term papers all the time.
How fast is the turnaround?
Oh, I do 2 or 3 papers a day.
Ah. And what, 10, 20 pages?
10, 20 pages. And, of course, sometimes at the end of the semester, you get these calls at midnight saying, I need a paper by 10 in the morning. And so the price goes way up from, you know, 10, 50 bucks a page to 100 bucks a page. Well, what are you going to do? Pay me $1,000 or pay the school $7,000 to retake the semester? So on one level, it's just rational for these children and adults to spend their money wisely. I learned something in economics class, at least.
Yes. Well, I mean, it's pure economics. Okay, Nick, last words.
Last words? Support your independent bookstores and your independent publishers. If you got to buy a book online, find a small publisher, buy the book right from them. If you can't find that, go to your local bookstore. Put on your mask. Sanitize your hands and go to your local bookstore. Avoid that big, big company that we all know that is dominating our planet to this day.
Very good.
That's my final word. Yeah.
Fine last word. Very fine. Fine last. Now, I don't want to call me your last words. Good final thoughts, Nick.
Thank you very much.
All right. You've been listening to Nick Mamatas, who is a writer out of Oakland, California, and the author of The Planet Breaker's Son. Nick, thanks very much.
Thank you for having me.
You bet. You can do as Nick suggested and support an independent publisher, PM Press, by going to blog.pmpress.com and look for The Planet Breaker's Son. You can also go to www.nick-mamatas, that's N-I-C-K-M-A-M-A-T-A-S, .com, where you can order a number of Nick's other works. For KSFR, I'm John Shannon.